Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're going to chat about Grace O'Malley, or to give her proper Irish name that we'll be using throughout today's episode, Gráinne Ní Mhaille. I do apologise in advance to Irish listeners this week. I'll be trying to use the Irish names of our historical characters in this episode, which is a bit of a challenge. The Irish language has some very creative interpretations of the sounds made by letters in the Latin alphabet. But look, I'll do my best. Anyway, Gráinne Ní Mhaille, she is often characterised as a pirate queen, an Irish noblewoman who lived a bold life of piracy on the high seas. And while that's definitely part of her story, there is a lot more going on with this woman than just that. She's a very, very interesting figure who well and truly broke the mold. She blazed her own trail. She lived life on her own terms, which was highly unusual for a woman in the 16th century. But that was Ní Mhaille. Unfortunately, however, it's a little difficult to pick apart the truth from the fiction with her tale, because the story of Ní Mhaille has been told and retold countless times over generations. And while we can nail down some historical details, there are a lot of anecdotes, a lot of details that seem and probably are apocryphal. Stuff's been embellished and exaggerated. And I've done what I can to highlight bits of this story that we're not 100% sure about. But as a whole, the episode isn't on the steady historical footing that, you know, we're usually looking for with half-assed history. So that's something to keep in mind. But all the same, it's a great story, and it's good to be getting stuck into a bit of Irish history here. A very popular request from many listeners. A huge number of alert listeners have sent in requests specifically for Ní Mhaille's story. Alyssa May, Chris, John Fennelly, Liv, Anna Fitz, Seanan, and Sam Elliott. All of these people, and I'm sure a great many more, very keen for a bit more Irish history. So let's get into it here. Let's get stuck in. A lot to get across today. So let's dive in with the story of Grace O'Malley, as she's known to history, Gráinne Ní Mhaille. Here we go. We're going all the way back to around the year 1530, when the young Gráinne Ní Mhaille was born. She was the daughter of Orne Dubhdara Ní Mhaille and Mí Ní Mhaille, with her father Orne being not only the chief of the name of Clan Ní Mhaille, but also the lord of Awal. Awal was a small territory found in the West Island province of Connacht, in the southwestern part of modern County Mayo, centred on Clew Bay. And Orne Ní Mhaille was a somewhat minor noble in the grand scheme of things. He was a vassal to Clan MacWilliam, the rulers of most of County Mayo. And the Ní Mhaille clan was a little different to most other Irish clans at the time, interestingly, because they principally made their living from the sea, not the land. Ireland was, and in many cases still is, a highly agrarian nation. Farming has always been a huge part of Irish history. But the Ní Mhaillers, they relied a lot more heavily on the sea for their food and their livelihood compared to other Irish clans. And I will say this, it wasn't just food that the Ní Mhaille took from the sea as well. The strong seafaring tradition that this clan had meant that they gained also a reputation for piracy. But as we've talked about plenty of times on the show before, piracy is in the eye of the beholder. As far as the Ní Mhaillers were concerned, all they were doing was enforcing their authority over their territorial waters by doing things like extracting taxes and tributes from those who sailed through them, and also potentially from those who lived on their coastlines, and also those who didn't, and who lived on completely different coastlines in completely different parts of the world, from Scotland to Spain. But look, you know, at the end of the day, if these people didn't want to be raided and pillaged, then they shouldn't have had all these wonderfully valuable and easily transportable goods, should they? Very little of this is certain, honestly. The Awalias may have sailed far and wide, they may have looted and plundered ships and settlements all across the northeast Atlantic, or they may have just restricted themselves to taxing fishermen and farmers closer to home. We're not 100% sure. We do know that there was a concept in Ireland at the time known as black rent, which, well, not to put too fine a point on it, was essentially just protection payments, and rulers like the Awalias would come along, they'd demand payment, usually taken in cattle, for farmers and for fishermen, in the Awalias case, to work in their lands and waters. And then, in addition to these black rents, there were the payments extracted from anyone sailing through the waters that were controlled by the Awalias. A toll payment, I suppose you could put it. But then again, from the perspectives of others, it could also be seen as piracy. And the Awalias also seem to be involved at least a little bit in smuggling operations, bringing things like barrels of Spanish wine into Ireland on the down low. Again, the sort of thing you might expect from a pirate. But honestly, the extent of their piratical activities remains largely speculative. We just don't know for sure. Anyway, as a young girl, Niwalia grew up with a strong affinity for the sea, as was the way of her clan, and more broadly had quite an unusual upbringing for a girl of her time. Women under Irish law, Brehon law, as it was also known, at the time, they enjoyed more legal rights than women in many other European societies when it came to things like property and status. But that's not to say that things were equal, far from it. Women were still expected to behave a certain way. There were still very high social costs paid by women who didn't meet the restrictive expectations placed upon them. But this didn't bother to seem Niwalia as a young girl or even as an older woman, or for that matter, her father, Orne. He raised his daughter without paying much heed at all to how a woman should behave, and the two of them well and truly ignored the established social norms of the time. Niwalia was raised as her father's heir, educated and equipped for the life of an Irish noble, and thoroughly prepared for the eventual inheritance of his lands and authority as chief of the name for Clan Awalia. And Niwalia being groomed for leadership in this way, being essentially proclaimed as an heir, was very remarkable, very unusual, because despite the expanded legal rights of women, relatively speaking, in Ireland at this time, under the Irish succession system known as Tanistry, the Tornishta, the heir, the second in command, could only ever be male. So it was a very unusual thing for Niwalia to be set up as essentially a Tornishta, not in name, but in practice. Eoin, her father, well and truly bucked the trend of Irish succession laws with his daughter, making it very clear to everyone that he expected Niwalia to inherit the lordship of Awal when he died. And it's remarkable for another reason as well, because Eoin already had a son. He had a son from a previous marriage with a previous wife, and for some reason, I don't know why, this poor kid was completely overlooked by his old man once his half-sister Niwalia came along and just stole pole position from him. Anyway, that's how it went. Eoin ensured that his daughter had a first-rate education, as befitted her as a lordly heir, and Niwalia was known to be able to speak Latin, French, and Spanish, in addition to her native Irish, although not, it's thought, English. If she did learn how to speak English, she didn't seem to want to speak it all that much, as we'll come to much later in the story. But anyway, in addition to languages and all the other stuff that came with the typical education of a well-bred noble, Niwalia was, of course, taught the ways of the sea, as befitted a scion of the Awalia clan. By the time she was a teenager, she was a skilled sailor. She was well-versed in everything from sailing a ship to leading its crew. She knew how to navigate by both the stars and with a compass, and also, presumably, knew how to loot and pillage and plunder, if the stories about the Awalias are true. Based on tales from the time, Niwalia loved taking to the sea. There's one story that is probably apocryphal, to be honest, but it's often retold to demonstrate just how keen a sailor Niwalia was, even as a young girl. The story goes that when she was very young, her old man wouldn't let her come on a sea journey with him this one time, and gave the reason that her long hair would get caught up in the ropes and the rigging of the ship. And so apparently, young Niwalia just sheared all of her hair off so her dad wouldn't have an excuse to prevent her from coming along, and after that accompanied him on all of his voyages for years thereafter. Now, she got a nickname for doing this, Gráinne Wall, right? Gráinne the Bald, which is a name that she's still sometimes known to known by even today. But also, this might not be true at all. And the Irish word for bald, wall, sounds a lot like her clan name, Wallia. So it might just be completely apocryphal, something that someone made up one time because they thought it would be a cool story. Anyway, in the immortal words of the philosopher Ferris Bueller, life moves pretty fast. And in 1546, young New Wallia, just 16 or so years of age, was married. She married another noble. I wasn't able to find out how old this bloke was, but based on the way things usually went back then, I'm not too optimistic about them having similar ages. But his name was Donal O'Flaherty, and actually, now that I think about it, there was a chance that there's actually a chance that he was a younger bloke after all, because Donal was the tarnisher of the chief of the name of Clan O'Flaherty. So unless his dad was like super old as the heir, Donal couldn't have been too much older than New Wallia. Maybe, 20 years or so. Gross. Anyway, because he was the tarnisher of his clan's leadership, and because New Wallia was also, well, she wasn't exactly the tarnisher, not officially because she was a woman, but in practical terms, she was her father's heir as well. Because of this, right, these two were a very good political match. The O'Wallias and the O'Flaherty's had a good relationship, and Donal had excellent political prospects to inherit further lordships in the future. But unfortunately, one thing that Donal lacked was good political sense, because he was, by all accounts, a rather short-tempered bloke who lacked foresightedness. He was quick to anger and take offence, and seemed to often be obsessed with righting perceived wrongs against him. And while New Wallia and Donal seemed to have had a reasonably productive marriage, certainly in a literal sense, they had three kids together, Donal did not, I have to say, do the best job of keeping his political house in order. To explain this situation, we have to zoom out here, a long way out, and talk about the political climate of Ireland in the mid-16th century, because this serves as the backdrop for New Wallia's story, not just in the context of her marriage to Donal, but also what she would end up doing in later years as well. So let's get into this here. In the 16th century, Ireland was divided, generally speaking, in two. There was Dublin and other major eastern coastal settlements that were dominated by the English, both in a political and a cultural sense, as they underwent continued Anglicisation. In these places, Irish language, Irish culture was replaced by English language and English culture, and much of the east of the island was under de facto English control. English monarchs had referred to themselves as the Lords of Ireland for centuries, more or less since the time of the Norman Conquest. But in real terms, this lordship only extended, as I say, to much of the east of Ireland, because the other region of Ireland, the other division of Ireland, if you like, the west, the area that our mate New Wallia is from, was very much independent and autonomous in real terms. Even if the English claimed dominion over the people out west, they didn't actually have it. Authority was instead held by people like the New Wallias, the O'Flaherty's, the McWilliams, and countless other clans as well. Chieftains, lords, kings, all of these people deeply entangled in a complex system of vassals and suzerains. This system was held together with family links and political alliances, but it also saw plenty of inter-clan warfare between the Irish themselves. They fought each other for increased power or wealth or territory or whatever else. But even if they fought each other, there is nothing they loved more than fighting the English. And for centuries, the Irish resisted English incursions into the west of the island. And even if they couldn't drive them back out of places like Dublin and just dump them in the Irish Sea, for centuries, the Irish undermined English authority in Ireland and took advantage of the wars and the political crises that the English faced elsewhere, the Hundred Years' War, the Black Death, whatever else. They took advantage of things like this to weaken the English position in Ireland whenever they could. However, in 1542, the English King Henry VIII formalised the English position on Ireland by proclaiming himself King of Ireland, and in doing so created the Kingdom of Ireland. And this would be the first major step towards a massive shift in the direction that Ireland's history would take, one that we talked about in great detail in episode 182, The 9 Years' War, get across it. And while that conflict is still half a century away when New Wallia married Donal O'Flaherty, its stage is well and truly being set, as evidenced by Donal's eventual fate. Because as we move now into the mid and then the back half of the 16th century, the English adopted a much more aggressive position in their conquest and occupation of Ireland. After Henry VIII's death in 1547, the English continued to colonise Ireland, seeking to expand their area of influence and control further and further westward. And as they did so, they settled Irish lands with English colonists, they repressed the use of the Irish language, they banned Catholic practices, they shuttered Irish monasteries, and slowly but steadily siphoned real power away from local Irish lords. And the principal political mechanism used by the English to do this last thing specifically, was something called surrender and re-grant. Irish lords were heavily incentivized by the English to surrender their authority over to these conquerors, who would then reinstall them as officially recognized English subjects once they accepted English authority and swore an oath to the crown. And it was this process that saw Ireland converted from its traditional clan authority structure, from its traditional legal systems like Brehon law and Tanistry, and instead become a part of England's late feudal system instead. It also saw a great number of Irish lords shift not just politically, but culturally as well. After accepting the terms of surrender and re-grant, Irish lords were required to speak English, convert to Anglicanism, and follow English laws and customs. And surrender and re-grant was very successful. And you can see why, because in the face of this English invasion and conquest of Ireland, Irish lords had two choices. They could either resist and fight for their lands and their titles, and then, if defeated, lose their lands and their titles, and also potentially their lives at the hands of the English, or they could accept the terms of these powerful invaders, and in doing so, retain their lands and their titles under English authority, of course. And on top of this, gain the favour and support and the protection of these conquerors who were overtaking the island. So there were some very pragmatic reasons to accept surrender and re-grant. If you didn't, what the English would do would be to find someone else who would accept their authority and then support that person, usually a neighbour, in seizing your lands and titles. And the reason that I bring this specific example up is because this is what happened to Na Uaile's husband, Donal. It was a very, very common tactic for the English to prey on the neighbours of rebellious lords that weren't going to accept surrender and re-grant. The English would approach these neighbours and say, hey, listen, if you come over to our side, we'll help you take over your neighbour. So it's a win for the person who is already ready to surrender, because not only are they going to be reconfirmed by these new imperial overlords, they're also going to have the size of their territory enormously expanded as they usurp the titles and overtake the lands of the people who won't. And Donal, unfortunately, was on the wrong end of surrender and re-grant. The hot-headed Donal, he spent, as I say, much of his time fighting people that he didn't like, principally other rival clans, but also the English when he could find the time. And Donal was not keen to accept English suzerainty. And unfortunately for him, one of his kinsmen, one of his neighbours, Murrach O'Flaherty, he certainly was. The English fully supported Murrach in his bid for power, and they cut a little deal with him. They said that if he accepted English authority, they would support him in usurping the title of Chief of the Name for Clan O'Flaherty, a title you'll remember that Donal was next in line for. So Murrach, with English backing, squeezed Donal out. And because Donal was so busy with his other ongoing conflicts, principally the one he was fighting with another clan, Clan Joyce, he wasn't really in a position to respond to Murrach's moving and shaking. He wasn't in a position to resist the English as they made their move. Queen Elizabeth I of England named Murrach the O'Flaherty Chief of the Name, and then, before Donal could do anything about it, he was killed in a Clan Joyce ambush. So this is very bad news for Na Uaile, because, first of all, she's down a husband, not a great starting point, but now she's also lost her political connections to the powerful clan O'Flaherty, because it's Murrach who's in charge of them and not Donal anymore, right? And what's worse, Clan Joyce seemed to be in the business of finishing what they started, and they went after Na Uaile as well, hoping to give her the same treatment as her dead husband. Na Uaile, on the back foot, retreated to a castle on an island, known today as Castle Kirk, but known back then as Hen's Castle. And the Joyces advanced on this castle, thinking it would be a walk in the park to capture the castle and Na Uaile herself and deal with her. However, it was anything but easy for them, because by now, Na Uaile, she's a woman in her 30s, she's strong, she's respected, she's got loyal followers from both her clan, Clan Na Uaile, but also those who had formerly followed her husband. And as I'm sure you know, taking a castle was a very difficult thing at the best of times, and the Joyces didn't have the advantages of something like, you know, the mighty gunpowder cannons that would fell cities like Constantinople, episode 222, or end wars like the Hundred Years' War, episode 223, get across them. Nuwalia and her troops, they laid waste to the Joyces, decisively defending the castle and further, according to some tales, causing it to become known as Hen's Castle, as Nuwalia was said to have played the role of a hen defending her brood. But I'm not sure if this is true, because I found other stories that explain, that give other reasons and explanations as to why it was called Hen's Castle, my favourite of which was the story that told us all about how the castle was built by magic by a witch who then left a hen there to guard it. So, yeah, no idea. In any case, Nuwalia, she got the Joyces off her back and she returned to her native land of Awael, over which she now held authority after the death of her dad. She established herself on Clare Island in the mouth of Clew Bay, taking up residence in a castle that has become known as Granwall's Castle, and we're a little more certain on the reason behind that name than we are Hen's Castle. And it was here, during this time, on Clare Island, that the legend of Gráinne Nuwalia, the Pirate Queen, was born. Because after returning to her ancient homelands, Nuwalia returned to her clan's ancient ways, taking to the seas to extract riches from people by any means necessary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Nuwalia had at least three ships under her control, and many other smaller boats as well. Under Brehon law, Irish women could own and hold on to property like ships, even after marriage and the death of a husband. And she put this fleet that she'd maintained throughout most of her life to very, very good use. Now, once again, we don't have a firm idea of the size and the scope of her piratical activities, or, you know, as she would have seen it, the activities by which she rightfully made her living on her lands and waterways. But certainly most of the ships and boats that she had wouldn't have really been appropriate for taking to the open ocean. It's reasonably certain instead that she and her fleet reeved and pillaged up and down the western coast of Ireland, although they may have made it further abroad. They may have made it to Scotland or to Spain, as I talked about earlier. But then, of course, closer to home, Nuwalia continued to extract her black rents and impose her tolls on anyone who sailed through her waters. And she went out on these ships herself. Much of the time, she was off there leading by example. She was still a keen sailor and also a popular leader amongst her crews. So having her out on the water with them would, of course, boosted morale enormously. And I know I'm speaking very vaguely here, and it's kind of annoying me how I can't give you any ironclad details or you know, specific stories about what she did during this time. But the simple matter is that we really just don't know the extent of what she got up to with her affairs on the water. There are lots of tales. There's folklore that surrounds Nuwalia and her activities as a so-called pirate queen. But Nuwalia is a figure who people really do seem to have romanticized pretty heavily. We love to do this with pirates. We know that. And over the years, the truth really hasn't gotten in the way of many good stories about her. For instance, there are tales about her second marriage, right, in 1566 or 1567. The marriage definitely happened to a bloke named Richard Burke. He was a wealthy landowner. He was a powerful political figure from Clan MacWilliam, the clan I mentioned before. At one point, he was also the clan's Tornister. And Richard's extensive territory supposedly allowed Nuwalia to expand her seafaring operations, giving her fleet more and more places to launch from and prey upon passing ships. This is stuff that we can say with relative certainty is true. But then some accounts of her marriage talk about how acrimonious it was, how Nawalia got so sick of Rishtiad one day that apparently he was off on a journey somewhere, and she changed the locks on the castle they lived in and then refused to let him back in, shouting down at him from the battlements when he returned that their marriage was over. Probably didn't happen. I don't even know how you'd go about changing the locks on a castle. Anyway, there are other accounts as well that maintain that their marriage was a thoroughly functional one. It didn't seem to be particularly lovey-dovey, but, you know, political marriages very rarely were back then. And the two of them, it's thought, probably stayed together, at least in a legal sense they did, but personally they probably stayed together for the rest of his life. Who knows? Honestly, who knows? There are all these stories from Nawalia's life. How many of them are true is anyone's guess. I'll give you another one. There's the tale of the birth of the son that she had with Rishtiad, Tibbet Nalong. Now, Nalong means it means of the ships, and it's a name that he carried with him for the rest of his life. So there may be some truth to some of the elements of the story that I'm going to tell you about him. But I think, yeah, you'll probably figure out exactly when the story starts to veer into, you know, potential embellishment. Now, the story goes that a very heavily pregnant Nawalia was out on a ship, as she so often was, when she went into labor and gave birth to the young boy on the ship. He was born on a ship, hence Tibbet of the ships, Tibbet Nalong. But the very next day, after having given birth, right, Nawalia still recovering, her ship was set upon by other pirates, reportedly Algerian pirates. So they were a long way from home, or I don't know, maybe Nawalia was. In any case, Nawalia, apparently, after hearing about this attack, she leaps up, grabs a musket, and rushes out on deck to fight off these pirates herself, right, after having given birth the day before, and turned the tide of battle as she did so. Again, I don't know how true this is. I've not given birth. I don't know what sort of condition you're in the next day to be fighting Algerian pirates. But whether it's true or not, right, this should give you some idea of how Nawalia has been and still is perceived by people, and how it can sometimes be very difficult to separate truth from fiction. In any case, we move our story now into the 1570s, where Nawalia faced a brand new set of challenges, a newly concerted effort by the English to move further and further towards her and her neighbours' lands in Connacht. The English were using the same old tactics, surrender and regrant, reward an Irish noble that surrendered to them by aiding them in taking neighbouring lands and titles. We've already talked about that. And the English knew of Nawalia and her mighty fleet, the scourge of the western coast, but as she was still, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively minor noble, they seemed to have had bigger targets that they were going for. And while Nawalia was doubtless affected by the increasing English incursions into Connacht, she largely kept herself out of it. She focused on her affairs on the water and just let the English kind of do their thing with, as I say, without really getting involved. And because the English weren't coming for her specifically, she just let him get on with it. And this wasn't ideal for her husband, because one of the bigger targets that the English were going for was Clan MacWilliam, which held extensive territory throughout Connacht and who were also resistant to the idea of English rule. The MacWilliams fought the English as best they could, and Nawalia was actually dragged into the conflict at one stage when she was taken prisoner by the English while off raiding the coastline near Limerick. Now, don't forget, she's married to the MacWilliam Tornishta. She was a very valuable political hostage, and her capture was a huge blow to Clan MacWilliam's efforts to keep up the fight against the English, because they now held the wife of the clan's heir. This resulted in Rishtiad losing his position as Tornishta for one, but more broadly, Nawalia's capture was one of a great many factors that led to the capitulation of Clan MacWilliam. By the end of the 1570s, much of Connacht had come under English control, including Rishtiad and his lands. He was more or less forced to accept English authority after Clan MacWilliam lost their struggle. He had to adopt English law and English customs. He had to pay tribute to the English crown and accept an English garrison in his lands. And in exchange, he was recognised, as I say, by the English as the ruler of his lands, and he was also given a fancy new title to go with it, Lord Richard Burke. He was one of a great many Irish people and Irish places whose names were, of course, anglicised. Now, this technically made Nawalia Lady Burke, but she didn't seem to care too much for this title, and she didn't seem to care too much that her husband had been subjugated, because Despite the capitulation of her husband and his clan, Nirwaulya wasn't in any hurry to bend the knee to the English, quite the opposite, in fact. She was a very difficult person for the English to bring under their thumb, principally because much of her power was to be found at sea. She had a pretty sizable fleet, she had plenty of loyal followers, and she had her headquarters on an island, on Clare Island, which made her very difficult to conquer. To be honest, I don't know how hard the English were actually trying to bring her under their authority at this stage. Again, she was only pretty minor noble. But in 1579, when the English sent a detachment of troops to Clare Island specifically to capture her, she gave them an absolute hiding and sent her back where they came from, and they didn't try again for a little while. And so into the 1580s, we're in this weird situation where her husband is a loyal English subject, but Nirwaulya just seemed to continue to go about her business in the same way as ever. The raids continued, the rent raising continued, and Nirwaulya maintained her fierce independence even as the English tightened their grip on Connacht. Now, in later years, Nirwaulya would undergo a bit of a transformation in terms of the way that she's viewed by history, her legacy, right? In Ireland's ongoing struggle for independence in the 19th and 20th centuries, Nirwaulya was sort of reinvented as a hero, as an icon of Irish independence. And I don't want to sort of pour cold water on anything too much here, but she just wasn't really. She was not a hero to Irish independence at the height of her powers, and even later when she came into conflict with the English, as we'll come to, she was largely doing this for selfish reasons. And this is one of the reasons that she has been left out of a lot of official Irish histories. One, because she was, as I say, relatively minor in terms of her position as a noble. But secondly, because she didn't really do the Irish any favours, only becoming embroiled in the ongoing conflict with England when it suited her. Now, of course, this speaks to her being a very strong-minded, fiercely independent woman who just lived her life, as I say, by her own rules. But it also meant that her reputation for being a heroine of Irish history as a fierce proponent of Irish independence is a little undeserved, to be honest. But again, there is just so much mythology, so many stories, so much legend around this woman that it is difficult to separate the fact from the fiction. And when people retell these stories, they've always got an agenda, right? Everyone is always trying to push some sort of narrative. And even, you know, me sitting here doing this, I don't have a dog in the race necessarily when it comes to 16th century Irish politics. But whenever I tell you any story in any episode that we get across, my spin is always going to be put on it, right? It's impossible to seek a universally truthful way of telling any story because it just becomes naturally biased by the person who's telling it. So with that in mind, it is very interesting to think about the role that Nirwaulya plays in Irish history and the way that her legacy and her memory have sort of been, I don't want to say weaponized, but certainly cast in a certain light to suit political objectives of the day. But back in the mid to late 16th century, Nirwaulya was very much, as I say, living life on her own terms. And funnily enough, the fact that the English were asserting their dominance over Clan MacWilliam and Connacht, this provided Nirwaulya with a bit of a boon. Because in 1583, her husband Richard died, and under English law, right, as his wife, as his widow, she was entitled to a third of his property, which she promptly arrived to collect, right? So as you can see, if the situation suited her, she would pick whatever code of laws she wanted to use to make sure that she gained the maximum benefit. She arrived in Richard's land to take approximately 1,000 cows and a couple more ships just for good measure, and then sailed off back into her lands once again to continue with what she was doing beforehand. She's in her 50s by now. She's wealthy, she's independent, and in relative terms, she is reasonably powerful, with her power at sea in particular largely unchecked. However, this would change after 1584, when an English bloke named Sir Richard Bingham was appointed as the Lord President of Connacht by the English Crown. Bingham wasn't in Ireland to make friends. That much was made very obvious, and he brooked absolutely no resistance to English rule. There had been some previous English lords in Ireland who had taken a milder route. They had decided that, you know, you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, and They'd obviously fought battles when the need arose, but generally had sought to conquer Ireland as peacefully and as diplomatically as possible using this approach of surrender and re-grant. Not that that makes the colonisation and settlement of the island of Ireland any better, of course, but it does serve to highlight the contrast that Bingham brought to his role as Lord President of Connacht. Because Bingham came in and immediately started cracking skulls. Not only did he force more Irish lords to capitulate, but he also instituted a new taxation system on those who are already under the English thumb. And he ordered sharp reprisals for even the slightest amount of defiance of English rule. He went after independent Irish lords like Ní Ólaithe with renewed vigour. For instance, in 1585 or 1586, Bingham moved to seize Ólaithe lands, and specifically those lands ruled by Ní Ólaithe's eldest son, Orne, who was named, of course, after her own father. According to Ní Ólaithe herself, her son wasn't even given the opportunity to surrender to the English before he was taken prisoner by them and then later killed, while the English claimed that he had resisted them and then attempted to escape their custody, and that had been what had led to his death. Whatever the case, the death of her son Orne meant that Ní Ólaithe finally began a period of active and furious resistance against the English. And this is what I was talking about before when I said that she only got embroiled in this conflict with the English once it really did begin to affect her very personally. She watched countless neighbours and kinsmen even fall at the hands of the English, but it was only when her son died, even her husband being forced to bend the knee didn't get her into the fight. But her son being killed by the English finally spurred her into action. Ní Ólaithe rose in rebellion against the English with other Burkes, relatives of her second husband, who were still fighting the fight. And this rebellion continued for years throughout the rest of the 1580s and into around 1592. Although I will say its fortunes were very mixed. No, look, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. She and the rest of the Irish rebels, they were fighting a losing battle. And history eventually proved this to be true. They didn't really have a chance. They fought all the same. They fought like hell, but they never made all that much progress. In fact, the only time that Irish rebels like Ní Ólaithe were able to gain ground against the English in the 1580s was when the English had to go and deal with other problems that emerged, like in 1588, for instance, when the Spanish Armada was launched against them, episode 35, get across it. Ní Ólaithe and her rebellious allies, they used political crises like this as a distraction, as an opportunity to revive their collapsing rebellion. But before long, Bingham, back at his worst, giving orders to his troops to burn and loot the lands of Irish rebels. And in particular, Bingham targeted Ní Ólaithe and the Ólaithe clan as one of the key holdouts against English authority in Connacht. He sent troops in to ravage her lands and managed to turn her own child, her second son, Murrach, against her. He bent the knee to the English and he joined Bingham in fighting Ní Ólaithe. Tippet of the ships, however, he remained true to his mum, the young man fighting against Bingham tooth and nail all the way into the 1590s, but it was no good. However, because the English by now, they had a near stranglehold on power across much of Ireland, and Ní Ólaithe's ravaged lands fell into English hands, Tibbet was taken prisoner, and by 1593, she had nothing left. And this led to one of the most famous encounters of Ní Ólaithe's life. Having lost everything, with her lands under English control, her son and other relatives in English custody, Ní Ólaithe decided to take a new approach. She went over the head of the hated Bingham and appealed directly to Queen Elizabeth herself. Ní Ólaithe requested an audience with Elizabeth, offering conciliation and service. The time had come, it seemed, for the great Grainne Ní Ólaithe to bend the knee to the English as well. And Elizabeth surprised a great many of her courtiers and advisers by agreeing to meet with Ní Ólaithe. And so Ní Ólaithe sailed to London and was indeed granted an audience with the Queen despite her reputation as a rebel and a pirate. Now, as you've probably guessed, there are a million different stories that emerge from this meeting between these two powerful women, like how Ní Ólaithe was at one point handed a fine lace handkerchief by a lady in waiting after she sneezed, which Ní Ólaithe then blew her nose on and threw into a fire, not realizing that it wasn't, you know, disposable. Don't know if that actually happened, but I tell you this, there are a few commonly accepted things about the meeting between these two women that do seem to have happened. Firstly, the fact that the meeting took place entirely in Latin. As I said right at the top of the episode, Ní Ólaithe either could not or would not speak English, and Queen Elizabeth certainly couldn't speak Irish, so she and Elizabeth negotiated in their shared tongue of Latin. Secondly, Nirwalya came to the meeting armed, hiding a small dagger in her clothing, and when the royal guards found it, they were outraged, of course, coming before the Queen of England with a weapon. But Elizabeth didn't seem to mind, and not only accepted Nirwalya's explanation that this dagger was for self-defence, but also let her keep it during the meeting, which is very interesting indeed. But thirdly, and more certifiably, the two of them actually came to terms as to what was going to take place moving forward. Nirwalya is in her 60s by this stage, don't forget, and offered to place herself at Elizabeth's service. And the official record of Nirwalya's offer to Elizabeth, as was written down by the English at the time, it went as follows. Free liberty during her life to invade with sword and fire all your highness's enemies, wheresoever they are or shall be. So this is a 60-something-year-old woman coming before the Queen of England and promising her sword and fire. Nirwalya's still bloody got it, I tell you what. But in exchange for this offer of service, Nirwalya asked for her son Tibbet and other relatives to be released from English custody and for her and Tibbet's lands to be restored to the Awalya clan under English authority. She was essentially trying to angle for the surrender and re-grant after already having fought a war of rebellion. But she went further than this. She told Elizabeth of Bingham's merciless conduct in Ireland, of the killing of her elder son Orne, and Bingham's depredations in bringing Connacht under control. And finally, she appealed to Elizabeth to allow her to live out her remaining years in her own lands as an English subject with her family restored to their former positions. Now, obviously, this wasn't really how the English did things. Nirwalya, as I say, was trying to get the old surrender and re-grant treatment after having fought in furious rebellion. But for whatever reason, despite Nirwalya's reputation as a rebel, Elizabeth decided to accept her petition. She ordered the release of Nirwalya's son and other relatives. She ordered the restoration of their lands, under English authority, of course, and even allowed for a pension for Nirwalya in the form of a slight tax exemption so she could maintain herself independently. And what's more, right, Bingham, who seems to have displeased the Queen around this time, he ended up being the subject of a royal investigation and faced charges for his behaviour throughout his time conquering Connacht, although he only got a slap on the wrist in the end. He got a temporary suspension from office. Anyway, Nirwalya, she returned to Ireland with these orders that had been given to her by the Queen and confronted Bingham, ordered him to release her son or other relatives and turn over the lands that he'd conquered back to the Awalia clan, who were going to, again, rule over these lands under English authority. However, Bingham, oh boy, he dragged his feet in releasing Tibbet and was not very happy about the fact that Nirwalya had won over the Queen in this way. And while he did ultimately follow the orders that Elizabeth had given, he did insist upon stationing a garrison of English troops in Nirwalya's land and made her pay for their upkeep, which certainly put a lot of pressure on her finances and ultimately meant that Nirwalya sailed back to London in 1595 to appeal to the Queen once again about Bingham's behaviour. And once again, the Queen took her side against her own, against the side of her own Lord President, which is pretty wild. I mean, how's that for the sisterhood, right? Although, then again, Queen Elizabeth did order the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, episode 19, get across it. So I guess you can never tell. Anyway, Nirwalya lived out the rest of her life in her lands with her son Tibbet and, broadly speaking, had a pretty quiet role in the next chapter of Irish history, which was, of course, an enormously important chapter, the 9 Years' War, which you can hear much more about in episode 182, get across it. I do recommend you listen to that episode. It will give you a lot more insight as to the broader picture in Ireland and also contextualise the current nation and the great many conflicts it still has to this very day in greater detail for you. But Nirwalya's newfound loyalty to the English crown was put to the test during the 9 Years' War as it broke out. Nirwalya and her son Tibbet, newly pledged as they were to Elizabeth, had to put their money where their mouth was. But in typical fashion, both mother and son kept everyone guessing. Nirwalya's fleet was forced into English service as the 9 Years' War began, but she also reportedly used her ships to aid Irish rebels as well. There are some sources that say that she fought on the side of the English, others that tell us that she returned to rebellion. And honestly, and in my opinion, it could have been a bit of both. Largely speaking, however, Nwalia didn't seem to get too involved with the Nine Years' War, and honestly, we just don't know that much about what her final years looked like. We do know that finally, Gráinne Nwalia died in 1603, the same year as Elizabeth I, when she was in her 70s, and with Ireland a very different place to the one that she had been born into. It was now completely under English control, and Ireland wouldn't regain its independence for centuries. And in time, Nwalia would, as I say, become a symbol for Irish independence, which was not altogether justified, because Nwalia, as I'm sure you can see by now, she spent most of her life fighting not for Ireland and its future, but for herself and her future. She only really ever entered into rebellion against the English when things began to affect her personally. So, to put it charitably, she lived her life on her own terms, for herself and for no one else. But all the same, Gráinne Nwalia became and remains an Irish icon, a woman who cut her own path through history and lived by no one else's rules. The remarkable story of her life being passed down from generation to generation to you, here and now. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Gráinne Nwalia, or Grace O'Malley, which I've decided to leave as the episode's title just so people will actually be able to find it. Grace O'Malley is the name that she's known by in most historical circles. So even though it wasn't the name that she went by, I've left that up as the title of the episode just to make it easier for people to come across this story. But no, thank you to everyone who wrote in suggesting it as a topic. It was a great one. Alyssa, Chris, John, Liv, Anna, Seanan, and Sam, thank you very much. And while we're in the business of thanking listeners, can I please thank the three brand new patrons who have signed up this week? Naomi CC, Arvind Menon, and Anthony. Anthony Blessing. Gnomes and Anthony both signing up at the highest tier. So true fans, true people of great taste and refinement wanting to get their hands on all of the extra merch that gets sent to patrons at no extra cost, by the way. It's included in the subscription, whatever you sign up for. Once you unlock it, it is just sent to you after 3 months. You don't have to, there's no extra payment as far as I'm aware. I certainly haven't had anyone complain about any hidden strings or fees or anything else like that. So if you want to get your hands on some exclusive patron-only merch, you can be like Naomi, Arvind, and Anthony. And sign up today at patreon.com/halfasshistory. Halfasshistory.net will give you a link that will take you to Patreon, and it will also send you to the contact form where you can get in touch like so many listeners do every week. A ton of emails this week. Thank you very much to the people who are taking the time to get in touch with me. Greatly appreciate you sharing your thoughts, your feedback, and, of course, your topic suggestions. Keep them coming in. I'm always in need of more. In particular, anything that... before I forget, oh my goodness... It's the 300th episode in, 2 weeks? I have no idea what to do. I keep remembering when I type the number into the episode title and then forgetting as soon as I've finished uploading and publishing the episode. I'm not going to do another X short stories because that's just quarter-assed history now. So if you've got an idea for something that I could do to mark the 300th, I can't believe this, 300th episode of this podcast... Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. I really should have thought of something ahead of time because 2 weeks is not enough time to cook something very special. Oh, well, look, maybe it is. If you've got an idea, please get in touch. Let me know and we'll see what we can, take care of. Anyway, thank you to everyone who's listening. New listeners and old listeners alike. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. And, as ever going to, is there anything I've forgotten? I feel like this is a very short outro. But who cares? No one's complaining about the boring housekeeping stuff being cut short. Anyway. Back next week. See you then. Until then, leaving you the question posed on Reddit. Of course, this one comes to us from Redditor Scrubs2009, who asks, how did St. Patrick drive all the snakes out of Ireland if there are no roads leading off the island?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.